From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on Radio West, the writer James Pogue is joining us to talk about his time among the occupiers at the Malheur Wildlife Refuge. Pogue was covering the standoff as a journalist, but his new book is also about his relationships with the complicated people there, like Ammon Bundy. Pogue says he wanted to watch an insurgency grow up and take hold, so he writes about the political and religious roots of this rebellion in the West. Join us in just a moment.
Benjamin Franklin said, "Tell me and I forget. Teach me and I may remember. Involve me and I learn." That sums up KUER's community calendar pretty well. You'll learn new things, like how to make your own honey, or write a story, or arrange flowers. There are new events every week, and if you've got something you want to show people, you can post your own events too. Check out the community calendar under the events tab at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In his new book, the writer James Pogue explains that in the years before Ammon Bundy orchestrated a takeover at a wildlife refuge in Oregon, he had spent his time in the West bumbling around, sometimes reporting, but mostly living out of the back of his pickup truck, trying to find something to say about what he was seeing, which was a society in the midst of a social breakdown. Pogue had noticed what everyone else had noticed, that the country was dividing itself into these irreconcilable camps. But in the West, he noticed this division was manifesting itself in these volatile standoffs where you had militia members and frustrated ranchers gathering together to challenge the federal government and talk about the Constitution. Pogue says in the West, public lands had come to be a test for where you stood in this conflict. So as the Bundys settled in at the Malheur Wildlife Refuge, he went to document what had happened and why. In his book, he traces the political and religious underpinnings to the story, and he establishes relationships with these players. He got close enough to feel conflicted about what was happening. The book is called Chosen Country, A Rebellion in the West. James Pogue's writing has appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times, and Vice. He's coming to Utah to talk about the book this week. When we spoke with him yesterday, he mentioned that he had heard about the standoff at Malheur at a time when he felt like his own family was falling apart. An uncle had died, and his grandmother, one of his best friends on earth, was on her deathbed.
I was very close to my grandmother, and she was to some degree like the cultural underpinning of my family. She was the sort of one who said how we were supposed to be and what we represented in the world and that sort of thing. And I think a lot of Americans have lost not only an economic underpinning. People live with much more economic insecurity than they used to. And people live with, I think, a great deal less cultural grounding. And some of that can be viewed as a kind of liberation from, old strictures and old structures. But some of it leads people to feel very lost in the world. And I felt like at the Malheur standoff, you had people who were, particularly the Bundys, who represented a almost pure and perfect distillation of what an iconic vision of American family and, sort of making your way in the world via your hands and being sure that if you used your hands and worked hard every day, you could make a living. Mm-hmm. And so it became very apparent to me very quickly. The Bundys represented something to a lot of the people who rallied to them that involved a sort of constancy and continuance in their own social worlds that they felt like they had lost. Hmm.
When did you first fall in love with the West? This is something that you write about hitchhiking out here, and first being kind of drawn not by the romance of individualism and whatever. I think you just liked the fact that there was a lot of land and there was probably going to be some freedom there. That was the first thing that drew you here. But then you would say you started to meet the people and you really started to like them.
Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, bringing up hitchhiking, one of the very funny things about hitchhiking in America is that in the West, it's not so uncommon. If you do it in New England, people look at you like you're crazy. But I mean, you know, I'm talking to you from New Mexico right now, and I pick up a hitchhiker between Albuquerque and Las Cruces almost every time I drive.
Yeah.
And I say that because there is a certain sort of wildness and a certain sort of feeling of possibility that I think comes with the space. And it comes with the fact that in a lot of corners of the West, and obviously this will be different to many people who, you know, live in Utah or some places, but in a lot of corners of the West, there is a sort of feeling that you can go and remake yourself. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very attractive to a lot of people. And I think that there's something about having public lands. And I write about this quite towards the end of the book as well, but like, I think there's something about public lands that encourages that sense, a sense that, you know, not many people anymore are going to go homestead on a, you know, or stake a claim on a mine or something. But the fact that we as a nation actually have that chance, that we actually allow for that in a way that, I mean, not to speak to France's, you know, specific public lands laws, which I'm not an expert on, but I don't think you do that in France so much.
Right. I wanted to ask you about the... I don't know if connection is exactly the right word to use, but the way you felt sympathetic in some ways to the Bundys and some of those people who had gathered in Malheur. And this stems back from the way you felt about your own connection to this woods that was just behind your house as you were growing up. And you felt this kind of defiance and freedom, and no one can tell us what to do. Mm. And it's interesting how embedded in you that idea. I mean, I think you write about feeling addicted to that land and that feeling, and that seems to you seem to really connect it to the Bundys, at least in that way.
Well, you know, I mean, I think this connects a little bit to what we were just talking about, and it's a great question because it's, you know. Another thing that I think public lands have done for us as a nation is that, yes, they are policed spaces. Like, I mean, laws apply in public lands as much as they do anywhere else. But they're vast spaces where you can go and engage in almost any sort of behavior, including many illegal behaviors. I'm not suggesting anyone do that. But you can go and engage in almost any sort of behavior without being seen, without being observed, without being policed in the sense of having to answer for, you know, why it is you're decided that you wanted to take a bunch of glass bottles and throw rocks at them. You can do that, whatever, up straight up to mining or, you know, all the different things that you can do on public lands, which we won't go into now. But, you know, and I learned that as a kid, just because I had 500 acres of woods behind my house, which were owned by rich people who did not want me back there.
Yeah.
And I thought that that was so absurd because they didn't use them. Yeah. And so I would go back and I did. I did sort of engage in my own little Bundy-esque standoffs with them and sort of defiantly dared them to call the police. And I knew those woods. And yes, I mean, you know, I'm very careful to try and avoid sounding apologetic for things that the Bundys do, but there's a feeling I think that they must have of having been on that land not as long as they claim. You know, they claim to have been there for 100 and something years, but, you know, for a very long time, and having had it folded into their sense of being, and having been able in their mind to be relatively reasonable and fair stewards of that land. And then to have somebody come in, you know, towards the late 1980s and really start to change what their interaction with that was. And I'm sympathetic to that in a way.
Yeah. So what did you start to, as you decided to cover, I don't know if that's the right word. I guess it is. I mean, it seems like in some ways you were covering what was going on at Malheur as a reporter. That's part of it. But it seemed more, I don't know, more personal, even more literary in some ways. Like that, you weren't just doing this as a reporter, but as an essayist, as a writer. Right. And then there was this personal dimension to it that you were really interested by these people, really taken in by people like Ammon Bundy too.
Right. Well, I'll tell you an anecdote actually, which is not in the book, which is that the closest thing I came to doing something like coverage in the sense of, you know, doing a short piece and just updating people on what was going on, was for The New Yorker. And they killed the story because I had told them that Ammon had invited me to go to his home. And so it was, you know, I was always very comfortable with, or let's not say comfortable. I felt like I had a pretty good sense of where my lines and loyalties were. But I very quickly got so wrapped up in it that it was almost hard to explain to publications what I was even doing, which was trying to get a sense of this beyond, you know, hey, these are the bad guys. Hey, these are the guys who are stealing your land. And there's part of me that feels some of those things. But, you know, for example, like if you didn't spend a lot of time with Ammon, if you weren't there in the sort of heated moments and seeing them pray and all that, all of the other things that I'm sure we'll talk about, like you didn't get a sense of what the occupation was actually about. And that I found very strange because I was looking at the news and I just didn't see it reflecting what my understanding of the events were.
Huh. Yeah, that's interesting. I wanted to get a sense of how much you think Mormon, I guess the version of Mormonism that Clive and Bundy and his sons thought about, how much of that was actually influencing what really happened up at Malheur? Talk about that broadly, and then we'll sort of back up and dig into that. But generally speaking, how much of that was a Mormon enterprise at Malheur, do you think?
100%.
Yeah.
And again, that's not to say that it was, you know, something that anyone in the church would have approved of. And
sure.
It's not to say that everyone who was at the Malheur standoff was a Mormon, which they weren't. But, you know, Ammon and Cliven, they do things that they believe God is telling them to do. And that is the source of their incredible obstinacy. It's the source of why, to some degree, you might regard them as truly dangerous figures. And it's also the source of their ability to be incredibly constant and incredibly firm in what it is they believe. So Ammon believed beyond any shadow of a doubt, I'm sure of this, he believed that he was doing like something that an angel had told him to do. And that had to do with helping the Hammonds, which were the family who had been imprisoned over what they claim was an accidental fire, what the federal government claims was arson of federal land. Ammon believed that he was helping the Hammonds and that that was God's work, and that anyone who joined him in doing that was welcome to do so, but that he was going to do it no matter what. And so he didn't proselytize because he felt like the strength of this crusade was strong enough to speak for itself.
I'm really intrigued about the way you come to explain the kind of the way Mormon thought came to be bound up in this kind of conservative political ideology. And it's kind of fun to talk about Bert Smith. Because those of us who live in Utah and have headed up north have seen Smith and Edwards. It's been there forever.
Absolutely.
It's one of the greatest places ever to go and explore. But talk a little bit about Bert Smith, just sort of as a figure, because he comes to represent in some way this the spin that he makes on his Mormon thinking and where that plays in the story, I think, is really interesting.
Right. So Bert Smith, you know, is a very interesting figure in the sense that he's someone who a lot of people respect a lot. And I would say probably even people who were on pretty different sides than him. And he's someone who believed very strongly in the idea that the BLM and the Forest Service were overstepping their bounds, were changing how Americans interacted with the land. And he's someone who I think became a bridge in a certain way. He was someone who took a very small set of regulatory decisions that had to do with how people ranched and mined and turned them into a conversation about what it meant to be a free people and to have public land and to have a public commons and to be people who worked on the land. He was someone who believed that the Forest Service wasn't just, you know, slashing someone's AUMs, how many cattle they could run a month or whatever. He was someone who believed that those actions represented something like tyranny. And he was very closely linked with a figure named Cleon Skousen.
Right.
And Skousen, as you probably know, he's the author of this book, The 5,000-Year Leap. He was one of the great proponents of the idea, and many Mormons would share this belief, that the United States is a divine nation, that there's a divine purpose to the founding of our nation and the future of our nation. And, you know, to a certain degree that the Constitution, you know, not to say written as scripture or something, but is a product of a certain divine will.
Yeah.
And so violating it is in that way violating something much deeper than just a few words on a piece of parchment.
Hmm. How does Cliven Bundy get caught up in all of this? You talk about how he kind of works up this philosophy that you describe as being partly cribbed from Mormon theology, partly a mixture of kind of his extreme right-wing thoughts. And then also, the other thing that's interesting about it is it's also bound up in this very Mormon idea of your own sense of personal revelation. So there's a lot of stuff that that he's putting together to come up with this philosophy.
Right. And, you know, I mean, I kind of wish that Cliven would write his own treatise so I could really – I would be better able to answer this question as to where it all comes from, you know?
Look, I have to say that we've tried to interview him. We have in the past.
Yeah.
And it's not easy to follow. It's just not. I'm not sure if he can write it down. It's just a jumble sometimes.
Right. And it's funny because Ammon is much more polished and political than Cliven. But with regard to the family philosophy, you know, so you have Bert Smith who, you know, until recently was still out there funding this stuff and appearing at events and everything else. And, you know, quite a major figure in Utah politics. Yeah. And you had Skousen and Cliven. You know, Cliven's thought came from these guys, but then was very informed by his own personal experience being a rancher in Southern Nevada.
Yeah.
Because what happened in Southern Nevada, and this is an incredibly tense conversation between environmentalists and lots of other people, but there were in the late 80s, you know, say 50 or so of ranchers running cows on public ground in Southern Nevada. And because of various factors, one of which involved the desert tortoise and certain decisions the BLM made to in conjunction with Clark County, they cut certain deals to try and move cows off of certain parts of land in Southern Nevada. And eventually what this led to was a lot of ranchers being offered buyouts, a lot of ranchers claiming that they didn't have any choice in the matter, because they would be sued or they would have their grazing rights slashed anyway if they didn't take the buyouts. And so Cliven looked around and he said, you know, these people are going to manage me out of business no matter what I do. And there was some grain of truth to that idea. There was a grain of truth where there were political interests on the environmental side in the county and places like that that wanted to just be done with ranching in Southern Nevada because it would be easier. It would be easier to protect the desert tortoise. And it would be easier for recreation and to preserve the desert and everything else. And that's a reasonable argument. Cliven simply said, I'm not going to play ball. And so he stopped paying and he said, come and get me.
Yeah. This was 1993. He writes this letter to the BLM, yes, basically canceling his contract and saying, look, I'm not paying you anymore. I'm not doing this anymore. It was kind of was standing his ground right at that point.
It seemed like, yeah. And, you know, there's a lot that Cliven has done that is totally crazy. That decision, it made more sense than people tend to know. It wasn't simply that he didn't feel like paying fees. It was that he felt like he was paying fees to a government that was trying to manage him out of business anyway.
And this is an idea that you actually mention that this did make, and I think you're the kind of affection that you feel for the difficulty that these ranchers have to go with economically, have to deal with economically, even though there is that argument, of course, that grazing fees are much cheaper than, you know, that they're paying are much cheaper than they would have to do privately. And there are all those kinds of arguments. But you do feel a kind of sympathy for these ranchers who are trying to make a go of it. And regulation and these ideas by the federal government are really making it incredibly difficult for them.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you think about it, this, you know, we had a government system that in, say, 1950, when the BLM was largely staffed by the kids and, you know, the children and nephews of people who had been ranching all their lives, and the BLM was essentially set up to facilitate economic use and to help people who lived in the rural West to make livings on the land. Well, we've now seen a sort of slow unraveling of that structure, and there are a lot of good arguments for why that should happen. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, I tend to regard myself as an environmentalist. A lot of people look on those arguments with sympathy. But on the other hand, if you had a lifestyle that was sustained by certain government actions and certain societal values, and then you see that unraveling and you see that way of life disappearing, that can be a huge issue for people. I mean, it's the same way if you had subsidized housing somewhere and then suddenly the government said, well, you know, in this other place, you would be paying this. So why don't you pay that? It's kind of an odd argument, the sort of grazing rights as subsidy question, because we subsidize a lot in American life.
I wanted to ask you about one of the other things that you mention in the book is that the environmental movement wasn't able to make a distinction between these bigger industrialists and these small ranchers. And you say, I think you put it this way in the book, that for a long time there was a kind of disrespect by the environmental movement for the connection that ranchers had, like Bundy and like some of these others, had to the land. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Well, so, I mean, this goes two ways, right? To my mind, you have people who are natural allies in the sense that they're both to some degree skeptical of major technologically based progress. They're both people who believe in ways of life that involve being connected to the land and, you know, without prioritizing, let's say, economic growth as the sole value to place on a society and things like that. To my mind, I've always been sort of curious as to why it's been so hard for so many environmentalists to see that part of the ranching lifestyle and of other rural Western lifestyles. On the other hand, there's the difficulty of course, you know, a lot of ranchers who are not necessarily doing this will claim that, you know, ranching helps the range or something, which is an incredibly complicated claim that is usually not true. Or, you know, a lot of people grow alfalfa, which is of course not very good for water supplies or anything else. And so there's some complexity to that. You know, the idea of used to people back in the early 90s would say that the goal was cow free by 93, you know, and that just made me feel, I remember reading that as a child. I'm not sure why, but in newspapers and things and thinking like there's got to be a better way because you're not going to win this fight. You alienate these people and they're going to end up looking to their natural allies who don't want to run people off the land. And who is that? Those are the big mining companies, the big resource extractors, the politicians in Utah, Nevada, and elsewhere that take huge amounts of money from, you know, right-wing shadow groups and things like that. Well, of course they're going to run to them because there's no dialogue in the other direction. And that seems like an incredibly huge wasted opportunity.
James Pogue, his new book is called Chosen Country, A Rebellion in the West. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West from KUER.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. A lot of people want to know, does Doug really read all those books? The answer, yeah, he does. No one really knows how, but we do know that he gets up very early. If you want to try keeping up with him, you can buy the book by clicking on the indie bookstores, Amazon, or Audible links at the bottom of the episode page. If you do, some of the proceeds go to support Radio West. So thanks for that, and thanks for listening.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the writer James Pogue. We're talking about his time among the occupiers at the Malheur Wildlife Refuge in 2016. Pogue was covering the standoff as a journalist, but his new book is also about his relationships with the complicated people who were there, people like Ammon Bundy. His book is called Chosen Country, A Rebellion in the West. Let me ask you about Ammon Bundy. You write about that. I'm trying to figure out at what point he really becomes engaged in this issue, because you mentioned, you know, for up until his late 30s, he's kind of leading a quiet life. I mean, he's got kids. He's not a conventional rancher. I mean, he's doing other things, but he is certainly, you know, his father, his brothers have been engaged in ranching, so he's very much connected to it. But at what point does he start to really pay attention to this and start to become a part of the story?
Well, I wish I could tell you something better than what he would tell me. But it's possible, of course, that Ammon is a great self-mythologizer. So it's possible that what he's saying is the truth, and it's possible that he's sort of simplified it. But the way he would tell it is that he was living a quiet life, running his trucking maintenance business, and then federal agents with sniper rifles and aggressive demeanors descended upon his family ranch, and he had no choice but to step up. You know, and there's a degree to which I always thought that that was a certain amount of just pure hyperbole. That said, I mean, what's greatly unfortunate about what's come out in the subsequent trials and failed trials trying to put the Bundys in jail is that it is true that, I mean, it's now a matter of public record that the BLM came in to some degree trying to provoke a fight. I mean, they came in by their own investigation. They said that they came in with the most aggressive demeanor possible. And, you know, they denied that there were snipers outside the family house. And then there were, you know. And so Ammon was changed by this, I think. I think he turned into someone who you'll never hear him utter – well, I've never heard him utter a word in anger, which is part of why he's so incredibly charismatic, because you can – you have to sense his anger and his force of purpose like sort of under the surface. But – he, I think, took the experience of the federal agents coming to try and round up the cattle at the Bundy Ranch in 2014 as a declaration of war against their family and as a sign that the federal government was so far gone that there was nothing to do but resist it. Yeah. And that was something I think that, you know, perhaps Cliven had already been there and Ammon ended up there after the standoff. But either way, that's where they ended up.
Yeah.
And he also, I mean, and this is, again, why he's both a compelling character and perhaps a very dangerous character. He took away from that experience that they could go up against the federal government or perhaps anyone, and with God's will backing them, they could win.
Well, as you said, they won. I mean, they won that standoff for the most part. So that kind of emboldened him.
I would say they won it not even to the most part. They won it entirely. They didn't even get so much as a parking ticket.
Yeah, yeah. I have to say, the way you write about your kind of your own relationship with Ammon and trying to figure him out is really interesting. You're right. It was like trying to get to know a really charming and engaging golden retriever on one hand. As you say, he's really nice and he has this kind of – I think you describe it as a kind of gift, a charismatic gift. And people around there at Malheur, and I'm guessing – probably down at that first standoff at the, you know, Bundy's land, they treated him like a prophet. And you yourself write about getting kind of taken in by this or caught up by it. You wanted Ammon to, I don't know if approve of you, but certainly you wanted him to like you.
You know, doing what I do, journalistically speaking, like you do meet a lot of compelling figures and you meet a lot of perhaps as a male, like figures that you would compare yourself against somewhat. You know, a certain degree of that going on, certain degree of like competitiveness. And you saw that amongst the people who were around Ammon, where they just wanted him to like them and they wanted to be liked more than the other person, you know, and there was this sort of, and I think Ammon, I can't speak for how he was when he was younger, but he certainly understood the force of the charisma by the time the standoff had happened. And so he didn't, you know, he didn't need to raise his voice. He didn't need to give big, inspiring speeches. You know, he just, and he would repeat this all the time. He would just say, I'm going to do what I'm going to do, and anybody who follows me can follow me. And at least for me, like, I was very impressed. I was very impressed by that quality of leadership. And I was very impressed by the sort of figure he represented. But more than that, I was just sort of like, he's a smart guy and it was interesting to talk to him. Yeah. And so in the first moments of meeting him, we sort of like got into this thing where we were very quickly talking. We were, you know, sort of making, I don't know, we ended up talking, I think, for like an hour or something without even like sitting down. And it was a very interesting conversation, I think, for both of us. And from there, I just became to some degree concerned about what the nature of my interest in him was. And so I sort of receded and like observed him a lot. And he became for me like a great character to write about because I, you know, it's only so often that someone like that comes around and is in your life and gives you that much access.
Well, it's interesting that he you describe his plans as being almost indescribably grandiose. So he has this big vision for what he's trying to accomplish, what he thinks this is all about. But I think the thing that seems to have disappointed you more than anything, and we'll sort of dig into this as we go a little, little bit more, is that he didn't seem to recognize the power that that might have had and the damage that might have had and the responsibility that he might hold. For Lavoy Finicum's death, this was the man who was shot after that roadblock, and we'll talk a little bit more in particulars about that. But that he had this vision, he crafted this thing, but he didn't seem to take responsibility for the consequences of it. Is that an accurate way of describing the way you feel about that?
Yeah, it is. I mean, the only thing that I would say is that when you say that he wasn't aware of the power, I don't believe that. I think he was fully aware, and I think. I don't think that you could be – like to recapitulate what this man has done in the last 4 years of his life, right? He won a standoff with the federal government at his family home, leading a ragtag army of 300 people against very heavily armed federal officers. He then led this standoff. He survived 2 years in pretrial detention. He won two federal trials, and he was not convicted of a single thing. There's something – he's whatever you think of him, he's an extremely capable person. He has an ability to get things done in the world that is beyond that of most people I've ever encountered. The idea that this person does not understand that capability and doesn't understand his charisma and his power is absurd to me. And so I found that, frankly, to just be totally mendacious because he would say, well, you know, people just follow me because we've got the right ideas. And you're like, Ammon, you know that's not true. You know they follow you for you. And I'm sure he's seen this with his father as well. Because, and I'll be frank, I mean, Ryan Bundy is an interesting guy and he's got a lot to say and he's very tough and all sorts of things. But I don't think people would show up and die for Ryan Bundy. Yeah. I think there's something about Ammon and Cliven that is very different. And so I definitely, I found it infuriating that they would deny that and that they would put people in danger of going to prison for decades, as many people ended up facing. And some people ended up, that happened to some people. And, you know, for example, in Lavoy, you know, people knew that Lavoy's life was in danger. And I think Ammon did too.
When did you first meet Lavoy and what did you make of him?
Lavoy was the first person I saw on the refuge. Literally, he was.
It was rainy or something like that. He was under a tarp or something. I think
it was a snowstorm, and it was a very crazy night because. And I'm sure some of your listeners will actually recall this night because Lavoy had at that moment just finished doing a very famous interview with an MSNBC reporter who was repeatedly goading him into trying to say, you know, hey, would you die before getting arrested? And eventually, Lavoy said, you know, I do not intend to spend any of my days in a concrete box. I love the feel of the wind on my face and the sun and something like that. And so more or less he said, you know, I am willing to die. And he had a rifle on his lap and he was under a tarp. And it was an incredibly dark night. There's snow swirling all around. And for some reason, occupiers had decided, you know, hey, we think the FBI is coming in tonight, so they're moving earth movers around. And so that was the first time I saw him, and I saw him around a lot, but it wasn't till later that I really started to get to know him. And he was incredibly gregarious, and he was like incredibly fit guy. Like he's just like really wiry, moved really quick, talked fast, was very charming. And I think there's no doubt whatsoever that he was the most he was the best liked of all of the people who were sort of in the center of that thing. And I think you'll notice a lot of, like, particularly reporters or even environmentalists had a sort of grudging affection for Lavoie. And so that was part of why, symbolically, you know, he was the one who said, hey, I'm not going to get arrested alive. And he was the one who was the most public, and he was the one who everyone liked. And so a lot of, like, sort of emotional energy was contained within this one wiry, you know, guy in a cowboy hat.
You say you were kind of touched by this lifelong dream that he had of owning his own ranch, which he finally does, but it comes later in his life. And you also mentioned that of all of the people up at Malheur, it seems like Lavoie was the only one who actually had a ranch to lose.
Right. So you had a lot of ranchers who were in and out of the refuge, and you had a ton of militiamen who, I think, inspired by Ammon's example and inspired by this sort of desire for some kind of life of coherence in the chaos of America in 2016, wanted a ranch. But Lavoie had wanted a ranch all his life, and he talked about, you know, watching Roy Rogers as a kid, and he grew up down in Page, the Navajo reservation. And he always wanted a ranch, and he finally got one, I think, I can't even remember, but just a few years before this standoff happened. And the phrase he gave me was, and now everything's placed upon an altar. And I just remember thinking, gosh, because Lavoie had not been a part of any of this until he met Cliven the day, you know, like a few days after that Nevada standoff happened, he was a participant. So a few days after it started, and he placed that ranch on the altar right there, you know, after hours of meeting this person. And I was just like, what has caused you to do this? You know? And then I met Lavoie's wife, who's I think a very kind person. And obviously, has a lot of swirling anger and sadness about all of this. Sure. You know, and I haven't met any of his kids, but he has a lot of kids, and he had a lot of foster kids that he brought to that ranch. And, you know, I think it's easy to kind of make fun of him for helping to subsidize his cattle ranch by taking in kids. And he got money from the state, which, of course, is ironic because here's this anti-government warrior. Yeah. But everything that I know about that makes me think that it was pretty genuine and that they did – you know, just I think that they gave people a reasonably nice place to be rather than a state home. You know, they're out on the land. And I think he believed really strongly in that project of being out on the land, helping other people be out on the land. And he got caught up in this really weird, much bigger project.
What was he thinking, do you think, Lavoie, when he stepped out of that truck, when the car sort of swerved off of the road, surrounded by Oregon State troopers? What, you know, there's always that question, was there some kind of death wish? Whether he had been just, I mean, what do you make of that particular moment?
Well, I'll say first that when I saw the video, so there's a video of Lavoie emerging from a truck, and he has his hands out, a gesture that some people might regard as up, but certainly away from his body and not holding a gun. Right. And then he turns again, I think. And then he seems to jerk to his side and he's shot, right? And so without sound and without the context of another video that was then released, it looks very much like he, unprovoked, as police officers were approaching him, reached for a gun, which I believe was there. I have no reason to doubt that was there. He reaches for a gun unprovoked and is shot. Fairly simple. That narrative is much more complicated today, which maybe a lot of your listeners won't even know, because it later emerged that as Lavoie was emerging from the truck, an FBI agent fired two shots, one of which hit the truck, one of which sailed off in the distance. Right. And at the time, if you look at the sink on the video, his hands aren't quite up, but they're moving in an up direction. And so it's unclear as to why the FBI agent was shooting at that time. This is not to forgive Lavoie for his previous action, which was to almost run into a roadblock and put a huge number of people in danger. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But so then you have Lavoie and he's screaming, go ahead and shoot me, right? So his idea is that he is a part of a project where they're trying to kill him already. And he was saying all kinds of things like this long before those shots were fired. But then once they were fired, you figure it must have confirmed something he already believed, which is that he was a symbol for the ranchers rising up and taking back America. Mm-hmm. And he did believe this and he talked about it and he thought that he had become a symbol and that people across the country were going to need to see him to some degree. We're going to need to see him in the situations that he was going to end up in order to get how grave this was. And so I think at that moment he thought, well, forget it. You know, and at that point, you know, he's heard shots. He doesn't know why those are fired. And then there's another officer approaching from the side. And again, I'm not trying to justify it. I think he just went for the gun. Yeah. And I think he decided that he blaze of glory. Just speculating. But yeah. That it's a much more complicated narrative, I think, than when the video first came out. And it looked like he came out just firing.
But what's really
attempting to.
Right. But what's really interesting is, of course, where you come down on this story, being, I'll use your words, wildly angry with Ammon. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if blaming Ammon is exactly the way you describe it, but you think that he is responsible, Ammon Bundy is responsible in part for what happened to Lavoie. And there's this story that you tell in the book that Ammon's law firm got in touch with you saying he wanted to talk to you. Mm-hmm. And so you had this opportunity to go and interview him. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about this because this is such an interesting moment because that's one of the things you wanted to ask him. If Ammon Bundy, do mm-hmm. you feel Ammon responsible for Lavoie's death? Talk right. about this moment because I think it's really revealing.
Yeah. I mean, when I said wildly angry, the thing I wasn't, I don't think, wildly angry specifically about him having put Lavoie in that situation. I felt as though Lavoie, to some degree, chose that.
Sure.
But then to hear him deny the responsibility, like, as you just said, like, that to me somehow crystallized everything that had been wrong emotionally about this whole event, where it was like, you have these people who are engaged in, frankly, in politics at the highest level. When you have something that's a lead story in the New York Times for days on end, you know, you are truly engaged in politics at a very high level. And you're not just talking about a few ranchers. You are doing something that affects how this country perceives itself, how this country talks to itself. You're doing something where people are dividing over this standoff, particularly in places like Utah, where, you know, if you spend a lot of time in southern Utah, there are a lot of people who took a very different side than there would have been, in downtown Portland. And Ammon had thrust himself into this, and he had thrust the people who had, discovered his charisma and agreed to follow him and be arrested and possibly die alongside him. He had thrust all of them into it. And if you asked him, all he said was, I was just doing my thing. And they were following me, and they could have not followed me if they didn't feel like it. Yeah. And it just seemed like such an incredible abdication of responsibility. And that seemed to be of a piece with how so much of politics gets done here. You have people who, politicians who have massive corporate backers acting on their behalf and saying things and working through, super PACs and whatnot. And they say, well, that's not me. And it was just sort of crystallized this moment of like 2016, like everything falling apart and no one being able to like step up and own why it was happening. And it just left me feeling, frankly, quite disillusioned and quite apprehensive about the future. And this, of course, was before all of the true craziness of 2016 had even emerged.
Yeah.
And so it ended up being a bit of a harbinger.
Do you think that the election of Donald Trump let off some pressure or steam to something that had been building that maybe decreased your sense of what might be dangerous? Because you write about, you start to see this up at Malheur and earlier with the Bundy standoff, people dividing themselves into these, as you put it, irreconcilable camps. You get a sense of where the place is headed. What do you think about that? Do you think the Donald Trump election was a victory that those people could claim that might let off a little steam?
No. I mean, the analogy that I would use is that it just squeezed the balloon in the other direction. Hmm. The steam is, you know, the air is still in the balloon or whatever. You know, in the sense that, sure, I think there's a degree to which, you know, sort of the pure insurrectionary rage that animated so much of what went into the Malheur standoff, and that I think would have been very, very apparent upon the election of Hillary Clinton if she had gotten elected. That diminished somewhat, but the question of like moving into irreconcilable camps has only gotten worse. I mean, think about it. There's nothing. The election of Donald Trump has not brought the country any closer together, right? And so the West is not exclusively inhabited by ranchers, and the West is a very complicated and diverse place, just like everywhere in America. And to the degree that like the divisions that produced by that election and by the chaos in our politics have only exacerbated in the last 2 years, there's no reason to think that's not true in the West as well. Mm-hmm. And the thing that, you know, perhaps might give somebody pause is think about in 2020, if someone who was a Democrat was elected, and then a lot of these regulations that have been rolled back started to get reinstated, that would be a very ugly situation. I'm not quite sure how that would play out, to be frank, because this rage is still there. And then all of a sudden, all these things that they thought were victories would start to be rolled back again. That's disquieting. But it's even more disquieting to think, well, we have such a deep-seated insurrectionary politics already in the West that we can't engage in environmental politics without fear of setting off an armed insurrection, because that's perhaps more disquieting.
Yeah. You mention at the tail end of the book now, you write this epilogue where you write about basically the disaster that was the prosecution's attempt right. at trying to convict Ryan, you know, Bundy and Ammon and Clive. And they were in the end, of course, acquitted. But you say that the prosecutors had this idea that Americans will give their government the benefit of the doubt. But that seems to be one of the things that just isn't there anymore, if it ever really was. Would you say something about that?
The juror. I mean, there's a juror who spoke publicly after the Malheur trial where – and I can't remember precisely what he said. But, you know, he basically – he called it – I know he called it a colossal failure. And he just said, you know, how could 12 people – because they got a lot of flack and a lot of people across the country – you know, sort of raised this hue and cry about white privilege. And I think that's a perfectly fair conversation to be having. And I think certainly that went into it. But he answered that question by saying, you know, how is it that 12 people from very diverse backgrounds pulled from a, you know, Portland metro area jury pool would have found all of these people innocent if it wasn't the case that the prosecutors just walked in kind of thinking, well, we got this because these guys walked onto a federal facility with guns. And so we're definitely going to send them away for decades. And the jurors just looked around and said, well, they didn't prove the case. And then it got quite worse in Nevada. It got quite worse because in that case, as I mentioned earlier, you know, there were these issues with the There are huge issues with evidence discovery and the government withholding evidence. Right. And there were huge issues with how the BLM had conducted that roundup. And none of that had ever been talked about. And all of a sudden it became clear, like, hey, the government did come in there with overwhelming force for reasons that weren't clear. The FBI had made its own threat assessment saying that the Bundys were unlikely to use violence. And so suddenly the Bundy worldview of the government as this tyrannous, you know, overwhelming, omnipresent force that's out to get you, you know, it's hard to look at what they did and not see some of that there. And I don't care what political side you're on or anything. And so, you know, you get some of the best journalism about what's happened with the Bundys by The Intercept, you know, which is a supposedly left-wing publication. But there were real abuses there. And so the Bundys were able to capitalize on that. And this then ends up in a situation where all of these people who are already angry and sympathetic towards the Bundys are suddenly vindicated, which is, I think, a true disaster for everybody involved.
Where did that leave you now, finally? I'm trying to think. You mentioned being disillusioned with what had happened with Ammon, his inability to take responsibility or his part of that. And you just mentioned that once you heard about the acquittals, that you felt done, as you say, with the whole saga. Are you still feeling a kind of, disillusionment about all of it now?
Well, I think the way I feel now is that, you know, there's a degree to which I don't care who it is. If there's someone who's saying, you know, hey, our government and our society has grown so disconnected from like what an actual life that someone feels like they can make, and like someone's, if people are becoming so alienated that we're living in a world where insurrectionary politics feels normal, then something is deeply wrong. And like on some level, like that has to be engaged. And I'm not going to let that go, I don't think. But to me, like the listening to people like the Bundys who aren't willing to listen back and who have imbibed an ideology that goes so incredibly deep and is so impossible to actually engage with. You either share it or you don't, which I think is true of a lot of people across this country in general. That to me, I think, is a waste of time. And at a certain point, like, you know, I have my politics, and I think to some degree my politics have hardened over this time, because it's like, how else can I expect to engage in a world where you really don't have a ton of dialogue, you know? And I tried really hard. And so I've been out of touch with the Bundys since then, which I think was a personal decision, but it's one that I'm actually happy about. I think it's given me perspective to actually work on this book.
That's James Pogue. His new book is called Chosen Country, A Rebellion in the West. Pogue joined us from the studios of NPR station KUNM in Albuquerque. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Tim Slover, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.